By its own terms, the Iran deal was supposed to contribute to regional and international peace and security. And yet, while the United States adheres to our commitment under the deal, the Iranian regime continues to fuel conflict, terror, and turmoil throughout the Middle East and beyond. Importantly, Iran is not living up to the spirit of the deal.
President Donald Trump announcing this morning he will not recertify the Iran nuclear deal. That was the landmark multinational deal negotiated by former President Barack Obama that curtailed Iran's path to a nuclear weapon. By all accounts, though, Iran is in compliance with the agreement. This move caps a flurry of executive actions in the last 24 hours attempting to undo President Obama's signature policies. He unveiled two policies that would undercut the Affordable Care Act. Joining us to help recap this week in politics is Molly Ball. She writes about politics for The Atlantic, and she's also an analyst for CNN. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, let's begin with Iran. We heard that the president believes that Iran is violating the spirit of the law. What does he mean by that?
Well, he is trying to find a way to save face, given that there appear to be no technical violations of the actual clauses of the agreement. But the president disapproves of the agreement strongly and expressed that very vociferously throughout the campaign. This is kind of an irony because Congress built in this recertification process on purpose to embarrass the president. They just thought it would be a different president who would have to go in every 90 days and admit that Iran was still in compliance. And so the president now, the Republican president, is embarrassed that he has to do this and so is saying he's going to disavow, decertify the deal, but not actually do anything to cancel or violate the terms that the United States agreed to.
So practically, what does this mean? Does Congress need to do something now?
Potentially nothing. If Congress wanted to, it could reimpose sanctions. However, Congress is quite divided on this issue. Indeed, the White House, the administration, is quite divided on this issue. And I think, especially given how much there is on the plate of Congress, there is very little willingness to reopen this contentious issue.
So basically, he is signaling to his supporters, look, I'm doing something on Iran. I'm saying that, these guys are, bad guys, and I'm going to stand up to them, and yet practically nothing really changes.
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite nothing, because diplomacy is words, and the things that leaders say matter. And so as a statement of, the United States stance toward Iran, it does matter what the president says. But in practical terms, he is having it both ways. He is trying to keep the promise to get rid of the deal while not actually suffering the consequences that could result from undoing the deal.
All right, let's turn now to Obamacare. The president announcing late last night that he's going to end a key part of the law known as the cost-sharing reduction. And these are payments the government pays to insurers to help out poor people pay for their health care. And, Trump has been threatening to do this for a while, but he was renewing those payments every month. Why is he doing this now, ending them now?
It's a really interesting, I think the whole health care fight has been a very interesting case study in the leadership style of this president who is so new to politics and to governing. He tried to get the repeal and replacement of Obamacare through the Congress, a very long and very frustrating process that didn't work. He was unable to use the force of to unify his own party or to use the bully pulpit to get that done. And so he decided to do what he'd criticized President Obama for doing, use executive orders instead. And the route he also decided not to take was to try to work with Democrats. There was that brief period a few weeks ago where he was chummy with Chuck and Nancy, and there was talk about getting the parties together. There indeed has been a sort of nascent effort in the Senate to find a way to fix Obamacare without repealing or replacing it. Now he is signaling that he's going to do what he, as you said, had threatened to do before, try to sort of cut Obamacare off at the knees, throw the markets into turmoil, potentially make insurance a lot more expensive or unattainable for a lot of people. That may not actually happen. There's probably going to be lawsuits on both the executive order and the insurance payments. And the Congress also could act. The Congress could appropriate the money to pay those insurance payments. But if those things don't happen, the experts are predicting there could be some dire consequences for the healthcare markets.
Because the insurers would pass on the increased costs to everyone else?
That's right. Well, the executive order allows people to buy skimpier plans and to buy plans across state lines. There is the potential that that could lead to a sort of death spiral process where the healthier people go to the skimpier, less regulated plans, and the people who actually need insurance wind up with these premiums spiraling out of control to the point where they may not be able to afford them. And then the stopping of the payments that the president announced today has the effect of removing the subsidies that a lot of low-income people use to buy health care.
So where are Republicans on this? They seem to be in a tricky position because they sued the Obama administration over the legality of these payments. They basically said the president can't do this. Congress has to do it. Congress has the power of the purse. And yet some Republicans have said, well, we kind of want to extend these payments because we want stable markets. So where are they on this? What is their reaction to his move last night?
You know, I feel like Republicans divided over health care could be a headline you could run in every newspaper every day since sort of the beginning of this year, right? And what we've learned from observing the Congress is that when the party in power is divided, what tends to happen is nothing. They are divided over this. They are very concerned about, among other things, the political fallout of the health insurance markets being disrupted and people losing their insurance. However, this is a party that, you know, promised to uproot Obamacare and the idea that they would not only leave the law in place but spend billions of dollars propping it up is also politically unpalatable, particularly to the right wing of the Republican Congress in the House and Senate. So in a situation where Republicans can't agree on what to do and Democrats haven't really even been consulted, what's likely to happen, particularly with all the other things they're trying to do, is nothing.
And then outside of Congress, we'll have lawsuits from various states.
That appears to be the case. Yes, several state attorneys general have said that they will sue over the rescinding of these payments.
Yeah, including Javier Becerra here in California. Molly Ball covers politics for The Atlantic and is an analyst for CNN. Thanks so much, Molly.
Thank you.
In Northern California, some of the worst wildfires in the state's history have killed more than 30 people. Countless others are missing. More than 160 acres scorched. Even the house of beloved Peanuts creator Charles Schulz has burned to the ground. And the winds are intensifying. The flames are spreading. Air quality in the Bay Area is as bad as Beijing's. Well, for the latest, we have NPR reporter Nathan Rott on the line. He's in Sonoma County. Hi there.
Hey.
Now, you actually were a firefighter yourself, a wildland firefighter, right? So you've seen similar fires before, and you've done a lot of reporting on wildfires. But, I mean, it just seems that this is apocalyptic. What's your view of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say that I've seen anything similar to this. I've covered a lot of, I remember the Rim Fire a couple of years ago. I've covered the Mountain Fire down in Southern California, a whole heck of a lot of others in Southern California, Northern California, all around. And then, yeah, when I was a wildland firefighter, I was up in Montana, but we travel all around the state, getting fires in New Mexico, Arizona, all that. And one of the things that it's really hard to describe, I've even talked to a couple of my old firefighting buddies about this here, is the fire here didn't just burn in the wildland like you typically see. I mean, it burnt into Santa Rosa, the city that I'm in right now. Like huge swaths of the northern section of the city were just totally consumed by flames. And so we do a lot of talking in fire about, you know, the wildland-urban interface, the WUI, which is one of the big issues that we have here in the West, more and more people living in places that are susceptible to wildfire. I would have a hard time describing some of the sections of this city as WUI. I mean, it is a city. And it's, so in a way, it was almost like an urban wildfire when this thing got going.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, just seeing pictures of it, it looks like, I don't know, the pictures you saw of Dresden after World War II bombing strafed the city.
Yeah, people were describing it as like an atomic bomb went off in the middle of a neighborhood. I mean, when walking through, I mean, I went to a mobile home park the first day I was here, and all that was really left was just the tin corrugated roofs that were on top of some of those houses. And even those were all twisted and melted out of shape. I mean, everything else was just gone.
Speaking of, you have some tape that we have that you sent us. You spoke to a guy named John Waldner at his mobile home in Santa Rosa. Here he is.
My motorcycle just melted to the ground in there, and everything's gone. My TVs, our table over there, everything's just melted to the ground. All the beautiful palm trees. All that's left is all the tin stuff.
Unbelievable that everything melted. At least he's still alive, so that's good. But
yeah, no, it was crazy to see. I mean, he had this nice shotgun that he had there, and the stock had totally. It was really surreal to see the stock had completely burnt off, and so you just had the metal barrels kind of sitting upright like it had been in the house when he had left it.
Incredible. So he escaped, but some others were not so fortunate. As we said in the introduction, more than 30 people are dead, and more are missing.
Yeah, I haven't done a whole lot of reporting right now on some of the people that we have confirmed that have been killed in this. I know that most of them were older people that had been trying to escape and were trapped. I mean, one thing that I think it's good to remember or remind people of is that these fires really got out of control in the middle of the night, Sunday night, Monday morning. And so a lot of people were sleeping. At that mobile home park, I talked to the managers there who said, you know, they started seeing the fire kind of come up over the hill. Their dogs were barking. The wind was really blowing, kind of banging doors and knocking over patio chairs and everything. And they went outside and saw this house up on this hill above the mobile home park go up in flames. And they said it was just like watching a Roman candle go off, all of these embers coming down and raining in among all these trailers. And so they started running door to door, banging on doors, trying to wake people up. There was a lot of police officers that came and helped them. I mean, it was minutes and seconds that people had to grab whatever they could, get in their car and get the heck out. And
wow.
So when you think of something happening that fast, it's kind of easier to understand why there might be so many people missing right now. I should say, too, I've been talking to a couple of people the last couple of days who are looking for people that are missing. I know that the Sonoma County Sheriff's Office has put together a team. They're going to some of these properties that have burnt. And they're looking with cadaver dogs to see if they can find any human remains. The emergency shelters here, the evacuation shelters that people are staying at, the Red Cross is trying to register people there, make lists of names that they can cross-check. They have a website called safeandwell.org that they're encouraging people to get on, put their name on there, let people know that they're safe. So hopefully that really big list of missing that we've been seeing can start to come down with a happy ending.
Yeah, hopefully so. What about the firefighters themselves? As you say, this has been 5 days that this has been raging. These fires have been raging out of control. They must be just beyond exhausted.
Beat. Absolutely beat. I spent a little time yesterday down kind of by Agua Caliente, so north of the town of Sonoma. It's a place that they were really worried about. And I don't know the name of the exact. There's so many fires here, it's hard to keep all of them straight. Even one of the battalion chiefs I talked to yesterday said he can't even name all of them. These guys said that they had been out on the line basically since Sunday night when these things started. They had taken a couple of cat naps in their trucks when they had a moment. But, I mean, a lot of the people, whenever you're a reporter and you go up to some of these firefighters, they're not too keen to talk anyway because they're going to get a bunch of, they're going to have all their coworkers give them a bunch of talk trash to them afterwards. But these guys, they were just like, look, man, I haven't slept in days. I don't even want to talk right now because I don't even know what I'm saying. Believe it. You could see it. I mean, they were just, you know, like bags under their eyes and just trying to get through this thing. And I know that that's gotten a little better here in the last 24 hours. A lot more resources are pouring into the state, as you guys know, from all around the West. And so they're finally trying to get some of these guys that have been working nonstop a little rest so that they can, get ready, recharge, and get back out there on the lines.
And any idea when these fires will be contained? Any estimate?
That is the million-dollar question. And I don't know. I mean, I think knowing the territory, the terrain that some of these things are burning in, it's hard to get to. And there's so many fires in so many areas. I think hopefully they'll be able to get a little more containment. I know the containment has gone up today. We're going to have more press briefings later tonight where I hope we'll hear that more of the containment has happened. But there are high winds in the forecast again for tonight going into the weekend. And so the concern there is that this will kind of give these fires new life and we might see some more growth.
Yeah. Well, that's NPR's Nathan Rott. Thank you so much. Take care of yourself.
Yeah, thanks. You too.
Okay, coming up, we're going to take a break from the grim news, and we will have this week's movie reviews. So stay tuned for that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Time for a break, a much-needed break from the news, and get some movie reviews. This week, we've got a few films to talk about that feature origin stories, one about a real-life civil rights hero, one about the most famous female hero in comics history, and one about the most iconic scene in film history. Tim Gerson is back. He is senior U.S. critic for Screen International. Welcome back.
Hi there.
Also, Alicia Malone, correspondent for Fandango and host of Filmstruck. Welcome back to you.
Hello.
All right, let's talk about Marshall. Tim, you saw this. It stars Chadwick Boseman as Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American Supreme Court justice. And let's hear a clip.
NAACP.
Thurgood, you're going to Connecticut.
Joseph Spell, Negro servant, tax socialite in our own bedroom.
This case will show the world if a colored man can get a fair trial in the United States.
There's only 13 million Negroes depending on you.
Don't any of you have any confidence in me?
I'd say you have enough confidence for us all.
Okay, Tim, so this is not about Brown versus Board of Education, which he famously argued, nor is it about his career on the Supreme Court. It's about a case probably few of us have heard about, right?
Yes, I know I hadn't heard of it beforehand. It's set in 1941, and he went to Connecticut. He was a lawyer for the NAACP at that time, and he was sent to Connecticut to defend a black chauffeur who was accused of raping and attempting to murder the white wife of his boss. And so Thurgood Marshall, played by Chadwick Boseman, goes there and tries to clear this guy's name. He can't actually try a case in Connecticut because he doesn't have a license there. So he has to work with a local lawyer played by Josh Gad. So they're kind of like this like odd couple team.
So he's a white lawyer, a Jewish lawyer.
Yes. And so they have to like work together. They don't get along at first. And eventually they put aside their differences to free this man. It is based on a true story. And the true story sounds a lot more interesting than I think this movie ends up being. It feels very by the numbers. It feels like a very conventional courtroom drama. I'm a huge Law & Order fan, so I'm a sucker for these types of things. And yet, this is the type of movie where it's just objection overruled, objection sustained, and that was not enough to sort of sustain my interest in this movie. Chadwick Boseman is an actor who I think is pretty great in kind of everything that he does. He's Black Panther. He was great as James Brown in Get On Up. He's sort of like the kind of like the same kind of cocky character he plays in a lot of his movies now.
He's also Jackie Robinson.
He was also Jackie Robinson.
He does a lot of these biopics.
Yes, there's like a Chadwick Boseman cinematic universe where he plays just real life characters. But the Thurgood Marshall character himself is not really well developed. In some ways, Josh Gad's character is more developed and has more of an arc in this movie. I just found it to be kind of by the numbers, and especially I think for a movie that's supposed to be about the fight for civil rights and equality, it's inspirational kind of only in the most sort of basic and easy kind of ways.
Okay. Next up, a documentary about one of the most famous scenes in movie history. The movie is called 7852, and here's a clip.
It had to be done impressionistically. The head, the feet, the hands.
He has broken the covenant of filmmaker and audience, and the audience cannot wait to see more.
All right, Alicia, I hope everyone has guessed what this scene is by
yes.
now.
The famous shower scene from Hitchcock's Psycho. So 7852, I think, well, was it 78 shots, 52 cuts in this shower scene. And it's all about how this scene in particular had changed movie making and changed horror films as well. And I am a huge Alfred Hitchcock fan. I have been since I was very, very young. And I thought I knew everything about Hitchcock and about Psycho, but I learned so much watching this film. It gathers actors and directors and influential people in the horror genre to talk about why this scene in particular was so important. And I found it really fascinating. Beautifully shot as well, directed by Alexander Philippe.
What is so important about this scene?
I think they should do a pretty good job of making the case for that, not just for this scene, but also the movie in general, but specifically the idea that you have a movie, spoiler alert for a 60-year-old movie, where you have a main character played by Janet Leigh who about a third of the way through the movie is killed off. And Alfred Hitchcock created a new policy for theaters where people were not allowed into a theater after the movie started. Before then, people could actually kind of walk in and out. And so that's like one of the small things that he changed because of Psycho, because he knew he wanted people to be there from the very beginning for the shock of Janet Leigh dying. The movie also talks about this idea that while there had been murders, there had been deaths in movies before, the intimacy and the shock of how Janet Leigh is shown murdered in this movie really kind of changed the way that movies thought about how you could kill off characters. They talk about how this movie kind of gives birth to the horror movement and the slasher films, so especially this idea of killing off beautiful, attractive young women and making that be a plot point and sort of a significant idea in horror movies and just kind of films in general. And so, like Alicia was saying, there's a lot of very kind of specific things about how this scene was put together, the impact on it, how it sort of shaped both art and culture and society at large. I think this movie is probably more for film lovers, but I think even if you just have seen Psycho, I think this movie will make you want to rewatch it.
Yeah.
I know it did for me.
Yeah.
Does it talk about the titillation part of it? I mean, here she is naked in the shower and kind of confusing the horror with the titillation.
Yeah, they go into that and how much you could show and how much you couldn't show and how much of a scandal it was that you saw her belly button. And
although
you
she, almost was a, saw she had the a body, knife,
she had a body double. Yeah, and the body double appears in the movie as well, talking about this. So, and you see the knife almost going in, but not quite. So he really was pushing the boundaries of taste at that time. And it was quite shocking for audiences, particularly because the shower is one of the places you're supposed to feel safe.
And alone. And you're not.
Not
either.
Watched. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to another origin story. This is a fiction film. It's called Professor Marston and the Wonder Women.
Dr. Marston, every issue of Wonder Woman is filled with violence, torture, and sadomasochism. This abnormal behavior in your comic is reckless.
A woman must not be told how to use her freedom. She must find out for herself. If you want to understand the mind of a woman, you can start with that.
Okay, so this is the origin of the comic, Wonder Woman.
Right.
And tell us this story. I had no idea it was based on true events, as they say.
I didn't either. I'm not a huge comic book person. I guess other people may know about this. But essentially, Wonder Woman was the creation of a East Coast professor named William Moulton Marston. And in the movie, he's played by Luke Evans. And he was a psychology professor on the East Coast. And in the 1920s, he and his wife, who's played by Rebecca Hall in the film, were actually developing a lie detector test. And so from the lie detector test, they meet one of their students, played by Bella Heathcote. They want her to work with them. And what they discover is that both of them are attracted to the Bella Heathcote character. And so they come up with the idea of, we should have a polyamorous relationship. But this is the 1920s. They have to worry about their reputations. They can't reveal this information and they have to kind of keep it kind of quiet. How does all of this connect to Wonder Woman? Well, the idea is that the movie sort of shows how by working with these two very strong women, the Wonder Women in the title, Marston gets the idea of coming up with this very strong, powerful comic book character to develop his ideas about bondage and dominance and all of this stuff. And so it's interwoven into what is essentially a story about these three people and the love story they had over the span of about 20 years.
Right. So that lariat takes on a different meaning.
Yes, yes. The lasso of truth. I know. It's a very kinky film and it deals with taboo subjects like you were saying, polyamorous relationships, bondage. But it's all done very elegantly, directed by Angela Robinson. I think it helps having the female touch on this story. It's a great feminist story at the same time. And Rebecca Hall, once again, she is just such a brilliant actress. She brings so much to her role as the wife. And you really do believe this relationship, this chemistry between the three of them.
So, and it's true, right?
It's true.
Yeah.
Amazing. I had no idea.
Okay. Now, another documentary. This one's called Faces, Places. It's in French, so no clip. And Alicia, you saw this.
I loved this film. I saw it twice. I saw it once in Cannes and then once again recently because it's so full of joy. It's directed by Agnès Varda, who is called the grandmother of the French New Wave. She's a legendary French filmmaker. And she teamed up with the young photographer J.R., who was recently in the news for his huge installation and his picnic that he had on the U.S.-Mexico border. So they teamed up and they travel around the north countryside of France to in the photo booth car, going to different villages. They're both filming at the same time. They talk to people, they take their photograph, and then they paste the photograph large on buildings. And it's all about reconnecting people with their place and also giving power to these people who have no power. There's some really emotional moments in there. It's also very fun. These two have a great relationship. You know, he's very tall, she's very small, he's quite young, she's getting older. She has blurry eyesight. He never takes off his sunglasses. So it's very interesting the way that these two people join together, these two artists, and they have this real great bond together. And together, even with their limited eyesight, they create these powerful images.
And what made you want to see it twice? What was it about it that you loved so much?
I think, you know, in today's very divided times, it feels like it brings everyone together. So even though it doesn't touch on the politics of northern France and the different parties that everyone might have been voting for, it really shows the similarities between people and that kind of community aspect that I feel is missing at the moment. So it just made me really happy.
Okay, great. That's Faces, Places. And finally, Noah Baumbach, he's back. He's got a new movie out with Ben Stiller. This one also features Adam Sandler. It's called The Meyerowitz Stories. Here's a clip. I had everything to gain.
Let it be. Maureen is plastered.
Really, they take all of the little birds and deep fry them and just... It's very sad. There are no little birds left in Italy anymore. They've eaten them all.
What's happening here, Tim?
This is a documentary
confused.
About birds in Italy, obviously. it's a new film from Noah Baumbach, probably still best known for The Squid and the Whale. And it stars Dustin Hoffman as this sculptor who has been married four times. And he has several children who were in the movie. Two of them are Ben Stiller and Adam Sandler. And the movie is just about, like a lot of Baumbach movies are, about sort of the impossibility of family and the relationships that parents have with their children and how those relationships get passed on from one generation to another. I, in general, like Noah Baumbach's movies. And what I like about this one is it's actually a little bit warmer and a little bit kinder. I'm not sure if he's getting tamer as he gets older. But this is, I think, a much sweeter film. And the interesting thing is it's mostly sweet because of Adam Sandler. This is one of his, you know, he's done serious performances before. But this is, I think, the most normal character that he's ever played. This guy that he plays is sort of a failed songwriter who never kind of lived up to his potential. And so Adam Sandler, I think, brings a lot of sweetness and a lot of a sense of being a disappointment and having to kind of live with that. And he has this really great daughter who sees what the great man that he is, what an amazing father that he himself cannot see in himself. And it's about him and his relationship with Ben Stiller, who's his stepbrother, who's much more successful than he is. His dad, played by Dustin Hoffman, who's incredibly disappointed with him, never knew why he didn't become the person he was supposed to be. And so this movie in a lot of ways is about failure and how one kind of learns to live with that, especially when you're in a family that sort of expects a lot out of you. I think the performances kind of across the board in this movie are really good. And I also want to give a special shout out to Elizabeth Marvel, who plays the other sibling in the family. She's the daughter who doesn't get a lot of screen time, but there's something very important that happens that she's involved in near the end of the movie.
Okay. What do you think, Alicia?
I really enjoyed this one. It's one of those great New York set, very dialogue-driven, quirky characters. I just love these kind of movies and filled with brilliant performances. Emma Thompson was the person you just heard in the clip, and she has a great little role there as someone who loves to drink and just chat.
And she plays his wife?
Yeah, she plays his new wife. And it's just filled with great characters. I think I really enjoy seeing Adam Sandler and Ben Stiller together in a drama, because these two have had a similar career trajectory, and I think they're both better as dramatic actors than comedic ones these days. They had a small role together in Happy Gilmore, but they haven't been seen on screen since, and I have to say I really enjoyed their dynamic.
Sounds like The Squid and the Whale Part 2.
Yeah.
Or
similar.
Not Redux, nearly as heartbreaking as that movie. Yeah. Doesn't make you want to just jump out into traffic like that film.
A bit more hope, yeah.
All right, Alicia Malone, correspondent for Fandango, also author of Backwards and in Heels. That's about the history of women in Hollywood. And Tim Grierson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a real-life love story from Philly. We'll meet Dina and her beau.
12 million copies, that's a lot.
Well, you know, it's the timeless guide to lovemaking. That's, you know, I've been around.
The documentary Dina, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Dina is an outspoken 49-year-old woman. She lives in the Philadelphia suburbs, and, well, she's different. Here's Dina's mom.
She has Asperger's, but she's not a full-blown Asperger. She's other little things, too. OCD, developmentally delayed.
Depression,
it's, yeah,
anxiety.
It's just like a smorgasbord.
Well, guess
what? You never have one thing.
Well, a new film follows Dina as she moves in with her boyfriend, Scott, who is also on the spectrum. He works at Walmart as a greeter. And we watch the two of them prepare for their wedding.
I know when we were first going out, I wanted to look really special for you. Because I wanted to be very near you and stuff like that. I really wanted to look good for you.
That's so cute.
Yeah.
It's sweet, honey.
Thank you, sweetheart. I try. I don't always get the desired approach, but at least I try.
Oh, well, Dina is directed by Dan Sickles and Antonio Santini, who are here now. Hi, you guys.
Hello. How are you?
Hello. I'm great. Well, this is a really sweet story of their love story. How did you first decide to do a movie about Dina?
Well, you know, I've actually been a part of, Dina's life for as long as I can remember. I grew up in suburban Philadelphia, and my dad, Ed Sickles, actually started a group for adults who are neurodiverse. And they've been getting together bi-monthly at the same sort of public library in suburban Philly. And I grew up going to these meetings.
And when you say neurologically diverse, what does that mean?
You know, it's a way of sort of positioning people who exhibit, you know, neurological differences in a way that sort of supports their autonomy, you know, and individuality, and reframes their identity in a way that we're speaking to how different they are, not how deficient they are, which is something that we tend to do often when we talk about people who are part of these communities. And we tend to overlook the things that are special or very valuable about them.
And I'm just wondering if you thought about or wrestled with these ideas of, you know, as you say, these subjects in your movie are neurologically diverse, and about being sensitive and not exploiting them because, you know, maybe some of them didn't fully understand the ramifications of being in a movie and having strangers, you know, be privy to the private parts of their lives.
Right. I mean, that's something that definitely we still consider, even as we're going about the rollout right now, you know, sort of protecting Dina and all that she's given us. It's still something that we're very concerned with. But, you know, this film is a collaboration. Dina is just as much a part of creating the final product as we are. And, you know, part of that process was showing her and Scott earlier cuts of the film and talking about what was going on, talking about certain choices that were being made while in the process of making it together.
Yeah, because you have shots of them in really private moments. They're going to bed at night and you know, there are these really intimate moments that only the two of them are a part of, and yet we're there too.
Definitely. I mean, you know, this relationship, it's an adventure for both of them, and I think that there's an aspect of us being around that they sort of liked too, because it almost provided a space for them to talk about different things that were going on as they were happening. You know, this is Scott's first relationship ever, and Dina is sort of bringing him into her home, but also sort of working to educate him as to what it means to be in a relationship. So this is something that we were discussing all the time, and you know, something that I think Dina's taught us a lot about individually.
Okay, so that is a good segue into this next scene, which is where she is trying to educate Scott about sex. She's really interested in sex, and Scott is not so much. And so they go on a date. I think it's to the Jersey Shore, and she gives him a present. It's a book, and it's The Joy of Sex.
12 million copies. That's a lot.
Well, you know, it's the timeless guide to lovemaking. That's, you know, uh-huh. I've been around. I hate to say.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm 48 years old, and I think I'm more interested in this than you, right?
I could learn.
I wouldn't like certain things. Like, some people like rough sex.
Uh-huh.
And blindfold and chains and harnesses.
No, that sounds like a dominatrix. I'm not like that.
Okay, that's pretty funny. But you don't see a lot of physical affection between the two of them. And that's mainly because Scott is just trying to figure it out.
Well, this is Antonio. Something that we try to say is that, you know, they both are learning to express love and affection in different ways. You know, because maybe Scott isn't the most physical person, but you know, he does sing her full songs, you know, at any given moment whenever she needs. And, you know, that's its own kind of display of love. And I think for Dina, because she was coming in from a first marriage that was very physical, she kind of had some of those expectations for this one. And, you know, I think part of their marriage has just been her trying to understand, you know, this new partner and what his needs are. Scott was someone that lived with his parents in the basement of their house up until he was 46. And he, as he's told us, you know, he didn't get to have many opportunities to kind of experiment. So it's almost like, you know, many people would have kind of this experimental period when they're teenagers or young adults. And kind of Scott is almost maybe going through that now at this age.
Yeah. And it is really a sore point between them. Like, she feels like he's rejecting her.
Definitely. I mean, you know, like, and that was something too that we didn't necessarily, that we weren't necessarily aware of until we really started production. You know, this idea that Dina was aspiring to a particular type of intimacy with Scott. And I think something that we've tried to embrace in sort of telling this story is that there are so many different ways of expressing how you feel about somebody, and so many different sort of companionships and ways of going about it. And I think that to see them honestly grapple with how to care for each other is where the humanity that's in this film actually lies. You know, that sort of awkward struggle to do the best that you can for your partner and maybe fall short of that in some ways, but then maybe compensate for that in others. I think that's something that a lot of us are engaged in our relationship, and that's something that makes the film more universal.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us and talking about Dina.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
That's Antonio Santini and Dan Sickles. They are the directors of the documentary Dina. Coming up later at 1 o'clock on To The Point, more on President Trump's actions on Iran and healthcare. Journalist Jameel Smith is sitting in for Warren Olney. But first, coming up on this program, the Dodgers are in the playoffs. The men's soccer team has slunk away in shame. And will NFL players take a knee this Sunday? Randy Sklar talks sports next on Press Play. We'll be right back.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
All right, a lot of sports action happening right now. The good, the bad, the crazy. It's all here. And we have the good, the bad, and the crazy, or one half of that.
That's
Randy
right.
Randy Sklar. Of the Sklar
Hi,
Brothers.
Madeline. Hi. How are you?
I'm great. Well, not as great as the Dodgers.
They're doing great. I mean, remember we were talking about how they were stumbling in August and kind of lost 12 in a row,
right.
And people were really worried. And we said, all right, hold up, everybody. The slate gets wiped clean once you get into the playoffs, and then see how you play. And they have all the right pieces. They have all these great hitters. They've got an unbelievable bullpen that you can trust when games are late, and a great coach who's making all the right decisions. And, you know, this might be the year that Clayton Kershaw, who is widely considered to be one of, if not the best pitcher of our era, this might be the year that they get into the World Series, and you never know what can happen.
Well, they have to get past the Cubs first.
And the Cubs won it all last year. Cubs kind of stumbled, and it looked like they were going to win this last series pretty easily at home, and then they lost at home in Game 4, and then they had to play Game 5 on the road last night in an epic game that was so long.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the game was 4 hours and 37 minutes long, and the Cubs...
Well, the Dodgers have had some of those recently.
They have, and it's, some people say that's one of the problems with baseball. It's like, their movies aren't that long. Why are we... You know what
Double
I mean?
Features
the longest
long.
Movie isn't that long, so why are we? And you know, there are ways to clean it up. But listen, Major League Baseball is really happy right now because 3 of the 4 teams that are in the playoffs right now are major market teams: Chicago, the Cubs, New York Yankees, the Dodgers, and probably the 4th biggest city I think in the United States, the Houston Astros. But truthfully, you know, in the late 70s and 80, we had Yankees-Dodgers. We could revive that again. That would be an unbelievable World Series. That would be incredible. Cubs-Yankees would be unbelievable. Cubs-Houston would be unbelievable because you got two great teams, and Dodgers-Houston would be unbelievable. So for baseball fans, there's whatever happens in whichever teams advance, this will be a great World Series to see.
Okay, and there'll be a game tomorrow to watch, right?
Game tomorrow to watch, and I think the Dodgers swept. I mean, the Dodgers, they just ran through their playoff series. So they're rested. They're ready. Their pitchers are ready.
This is a home game, so
home game, we'll see. This is going to be really exciting. We'll see if they are the buzzsaw that we think they are.
Okay. Speaking of the anti-buzzsaw, that would be the U.S. men's soccer team.
This is the biggest disappointment in U.S. sports and men's sports in a long time. Okay, they failed to make the World Cup next year, so no World Cup for the United States.
Put that into context.
Okay, 1986 was the last time that the U.S. failed to make the World Cup. Okay,
so they've like made the 30 World 30 years.
Yeah, 26 years. I think we've made it every single time. And we did pretty well in the last World Cup. We were in the group of death, which we had like 3 really tough teams, and we advanced from that group. This was a great team of great players. We have the best player in the history of U.S. soccer, homegrown, that we've, Christian Pulisic, who's young, he's 19. But the next World Cup that he's in, he's going to be 24. Now, that's not over the hill, but it's not, you know, the best soccer players are young. So you basically take away his chance to play in a World Cup and on the world stage and show what he can do. The excitement that soccer has been building. Okay, they'll put 70,000 fans in Atlanta for a soccer game for the Atlanta soccer team. Now, that's unbelievable. So there's a rise in popularity in soccer.
Is that more than the Rams are getting these days?
I'll put it this way, in an anecdotal story. I was in New York, and we were visiting some friends who moved from L.A. to New York. They have 3 boys who are the same age as my kids, okay, 10, 12, and one who's 7 years old. And we were walking in Brooklyn, and all these kids wanted to do was go to the soccer store that was there and like kick the soccer ball on the little thing and get shirts and jerseys, and they have season tickets to the New York Red Bulls. There's excitement. So now for those kids, you don't get to be excited about the World Cup, which is the biggest sport on the biggest stage next year because the United States isn't in it. This is going.
And they lost to a team that was
Trinidad
ranked
and
99th
Tobago.
In the world.
I mean,
99th.
We should have been moving on, and we didn't. Jurgen Klinsmann was a coach who we had before, German coach. He was fired midway through this whole thing because they said he was too stubborn and wasn't playing the young players.
So a little Schadenfreude there.
Well, he is
Speaking
German.
Of German.
He is German, so he's probably feeling all of that. But then Bruce Arena, they brought in the guy who used to coach the team. He came in and didn't do a good job. I think everyone should be fired. This is such a catastrophic problem.
All the players?
I mean, some of the players, I think you definitely need to keep some of the young players and keep them in there. But something new has to happen. This is terrible for U.S. soccer, which had been rising so much. And that's such a bummer. As I used to play soccer as a kid, and I loved and then loved this U.S. team. So I'm going to be sad. What am I going to do? Root for Portugal? Maybe. I don't know.
Maybe Trinidad and
Maybe Trinidad. Now they're not going to make it. They're not making it even. I might root for Mexico.
No.
I might
okay.
root for Mexico.
Yeah, root for Mexico.
North American team.
All right. We have a few minutes left to talk about the NFL situation and the national anthem saga, this culture war that's happening. Jerry Jones, the owner of the Cowboys, said he would sit any players who don't stand. And the NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell, also saying the same thing. Players should stand. Initially, they were criticizing President Trump over this, mm-hmm. and now they seem to be taking his side.
Well, Jerry Jones kneeled with his players.
Yeah.
He kneeled with his players before the anthem. And I think what's getting lost in this and what's getting perverted in this by our president, period. I'll say it. The argument and the protest and the reason why they're being protest is being perverted by our president. The players aren't protesting our military. And they are not saying we hate the U.S. flag and we hate the soldiers. They're making a peaceful protest. The whole protest started with Colin Kaepernick saying, I am uncomfortable with the racial inequality in our country. Police brutality is something that bothers me. I want to speak out against that because I feel like I have a voice and I want to do that. I don't know how to do it. So we met with a Navy SEAL who said, you know what you should do? And I'll go on the field with you. You kneel, I'll put my hand on your shoulder. And so when you kneel, you're basically showing reverence in some way and also making the statement that, like, something's askew here. This was developed by someone from the military. So now this argument has been perverted to the point where it's you don't respect the military, you don't respect the flag. Mike Pence used hundreds of thousands of taxpayer dollars. I think it was $175,000 of taxpayer money, if I'm correct, somewhere between $150,000 and $200,000 to fly to Indianapolis and just make a big show of putting his hand over his heart and then walking out mm-hmm. because he knew the players would be on their knees. The whole thing has now been changed and the argument's been changed. And it looks like Trump won because
The
owners who are his friends, who are the rich friends that he is helping with all the things that he's doing.
Why do you think they did that, though?
Because I think he put pressure on them. He put pressure on the owners to say, and public opinion is such in certain ways. The problem is the league is about 75% African-American. Okay. The fan base is about 80% white. And this now becomes a culture thing of white people telling black people you shouldn't be kneeling. And these players, they make the argument about, what are you complaining about? You're a player who's making all this money. You get to play a game. You get to do this.
So what happens on Sunday, do you think?
I think the most unbelievable statement that could be made is if Jerry Jones said to his players, if you kneel, then you're not playing. If his entire team kneeled, then what does he do? You're going to get all new players to play the next week?
Well, that'll get their ratings up on Sunday. We'll tune in to see what happens.
That will be fascinating. So we shall see. But my advice to the Dallas Cowboy players is let's bring this thing to a head. Everybody kneel. Let's see what happens.
Randy Sklar, one half of the comedy team, the Sklar Brothers, and you can catch them on their new podcast. It's called View from the Cheap Seats. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Christian Bordahl is here now without his twin brother.
I have no twin brother. But I do want to echo what Randy just said about being bummed about the U.S. not going to the World Cup next year.
Well, yeah, you are a huge
soccer
fan.
I am. And, you know, I've spent a lot of years coaching youth soccer here in Santa Monica. And soccer is, you know, second to none as a youth sport in many parts of this country, certainly here in Los Angeles. And the World Cup is such a wonderful, huge spectacle and time for them to get excited about it, you know. So the fact that the U.S. team won't be there, I think, is really a shame.
I know. And what are the kids thinking? Are they
I guess it depends on which gender you are because, you know, the women's soccer team does really well. They may not get paid as well as we've talked about on this show, but they won the last World Cup, Women's World Cup, and I bet that they will be playing in the next Women's World Cup in France.
Okay.
And by the way, you may not know that the World Cup is likely to come back here to Los Angeles in 2026.
Oh, well, maybe the men will qualify for that
Let's hope. Yeah.
Otherwise, yipes, that will be really, really embarrassing.
That would be really embarrassing, yes. Well, the home team actually always gets to play. That's kind of a stipulation.
Oh, I see. Yeah. No matter how bad they are.
Yeah, although that's funny because this bid is the U.S. and Canada and Mexico. So I'm not sure how that'll work if all three of the countries automatically get in. Huh, we'll have to see.
Okay, yeah. Well, fodder for another segment.
Yes, indeed.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
And you have a great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.